Morning show with Greg Berg. Let's check WGTD sports and weather. No games last night in the NBA because of the All-Star break. NHL, the Blackhawks off last night. They skate in Detroit tonight. College basketball, number 11 Marquette hosts Butler. Now the WGTD Wednesday forecast from the National Weather Service. The winter weather advisory is still up till 3 o'clock. Maybe light snow mixed with rain and freezing rain through the day. A couple of inches of snow accumulation possible. Maybe a quarter inch of ice. High at 36, winds up to 20 miles per hour. Nothing on the system right now as far as precipitation in our area. 29 degrees Kenosha, 30 Racine, wind from the east at 13. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We are talking about a really important topic for today's morning show, and it is a topic which my morning show guest, Dr. Jennifer Harvey, approaches with great frankness and forthrightness, beginning with the title of the book, Raising White Kids, Bringing Up Children in a Racially Unjust America. Professor Harvey, she is a professor at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa, has thought a great deal about this topic in a number of different connotations, but she has also dealt with this topic and concern on a personal level as the parent of two children and trying to figure out what is the best way, the most effective way to raise children to grow up to be sensitive, open, empathetic adults, especially at this moment in our nation's history when it feels like we are divided along some of these lines in a way that we never have been before. And various events have revealed to each of us how different some of us might actually be and what some of us actually think and feel about some of these difficult issues. And Professor Harvey is contending that some of the solutions that we might gravitate towards as parents, meaning well, with our hearts in the right place, are actually not the best way to go. And a lot of other possibilities are laid out in this very, very intriguing book. And I'm very, very excited to be able to speak with Professor Harvey about this book. And again, she has worked extensively on issues around racism and racial justice. Her previous books include Dear White Christians for Those Still Longing for Racial Reconciliation. Her work has appeared in many places, including the New York Times and Huffington Post. This book is published by Abingdon Press, again titled Raising White Kids, Bringing Up Children in a Racially Unjust America. And Professor Jennifer Harvey, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, Greg. I'm so glad to be with you.
I wonder if we could first have you talk a little bit about why this issue first, why and how this issue first became important to you. And I don't mean the specific focus of your book, Raising Children, around this issue, but more generally speaking, how and when, under what circumstances, racism itself became such an abiding force in your life, in a sense. I mean, your intense interest in it, yeah, and your desire to study it.
Yeah, you know, it's always difficult to know how a passion emerges in one's own life, but I grew up in Denver, Colorado, and I'm a, you know, a white U.S. American. I was in public schools during the period of time Denver was busing to ensure integration, and so I know that my early friendships, mostly with black children, black girls in particular, in that context, made an impact on me. But I also know that by high school, even though I was in an integrated school, that I was noticing that my accelerated classes were mostly white, and that that now I know we had been racially tracked, but no adults, of course, were talking about that with me. But I puzzled on that as a high schooler. And, you know, in my 20s, I ended up studying at a seminary. I was a committed Christian, and I started to learn reading theology that my belief that God so loved the world meant that God so loved the world, including everyone, and that justice was a critical commitment at the heart of God. And so that's really where my commitment to anti-racism emerged. In my 20s, I was living in New York City, studying theology, especially with African-American and Latino and Native American Christians who said to me, you know, well and good for you to be committed to racial justice, but as a white American, you need to figure out what that uniquely means for you, because it's different for you than it is for us. So I've been working at that ever since for, you know, about 20-plus years now, trying to understand what my role and responsibility is as a white American to challenge racism and fight for racial justice, because I believe it's, it's just the deepest passion of my life, truly.
Right. One of the things you mentioned at some point in your book is that often in a class that is about more than race and more than racism, when it is time to address the issue of race sort of head on, when you reach that point in the curriculum or that point in the semester schedule or whatever, you sense a certain sort of tension in the room. a tension, a hesitancy, a sense that we are about to enter kind of an intimidating subject matter, not easy to talk about. I wonder, I think a lot of us can relate to that. I wonder to what extent that is true for you, even in other situations, even outside of the classroom, even talking with peers and colleagues and so on, including people who are probably, at least to a large extent, very sympathetic and in tune to your own perspectives on this. How difficult do you find this to talk about openly?
Well, I find that other white Americans find it very, very difficult. And it's not just in my classrooms. You know, when my students panic, it's really white students who panic. Students of color are ready to go, and white students are like, oh, my goodness, could we please talk about something easier like abortion? You know, But you're right. It's not just about young people. White adults as well, folks who would say, and I think mean it, that they believe in equity and want to have a robust, diverse, fair society. White Americans are very afraid to talk about race, and that is deeply part of this longer sort of multi-generational reality, which is that white Americans have not talked explicitly about race, certainly haven't talked about anti-racism. And so I like to compare it to learning math, that people of color in the United States do calculus on a daily basis. They teach their kids calculus. They have had to sort of enable their children to survive. And white Americans have allowed ourselves to not go past basic addition because we haven't had to for our own survival, because we are insulated from racism and white supremacy. And so that leaves us, those of us who want a racially just society, very underdeveloped in our skill set and our language and our ability to navigate race and navigate racism and anti-racism well.
Before we go any further, I want to be sure to address something that you yourself address at some point very early in the book, which is that somebody might really be taken aback by by your book, just looking at the cover of it, the title in red, white, and blue lettering, Raising White Kids Against a Black Background. And here's what you write in the introduction. At this point, yet a different matter in terms of reader expectations need to be addressed. It may be the case, in fact, that the specificity of this book, Raising White Kids, already raises a few eyebrows. Why not all kids? Shouldn't racial justice matters address everybody? So I'd like you to explain why you think it is really important to, in a sense, set white children aside and think very specifically about how we raise them around these issues, and why this can't be a book about raising all children
right.
to be to think along lines of justice and sensitivity and empathy and so on. Why do you think the lessons of this book should not be, in a sense, generalized?
Thanks for that question. You know, in part it's because I feel very clear that African American families, Latino families, Native American families are already raising their children. They've long been raising their children to navigate, challenge, interrupt racism, and to live lives that are growing racial justice. And so in some ways, the specificity, white kids, is trying to be honest and truthful about the reality that it's white families who have not done this. And I actually think in the United States, until we can be more honest about that, that it's not everybody's problem, it's that white Americans have not taken this on. Until we can do that, we're going to continue to struggle with having the kinds of conversations about race that we need to be having. But it's also specific for another reason, and that is that it is different for my white 8-year-old to navigate society who looks at her, treats her because she's white in particular ways than it is for her friend who might be black, who's also 8 years old. Her black friend is not treated that the same way. That child, an 8-year-old African-American child, it has negative perceptions laid on them, is treated more strictly when it comes to discipline and assumptions about their behavior, is treated, you know, less often as a child and more often with sort of, you know, we tend to impose on young black children these ideas that they are grown and they are adults. And so my white child needs different strategies and tools to challenge racism than a black child needs. And it's different for a white child to learn that even if we believe and are committed to equity and racial justice, that she also gets insulated and gets benefits and privileges because of being white. And that if she wants to work for racial justice, if she wants to be a good ally to her 8-year-old friend, she's got to learn different skills than her 8-year-old friend needs, because her experience is fundamentally different, because the society she's living in, whether I like it or not, unjustly privileges and insulates her. And so she just has to live, it's a different toolkit, even if the goals are the same. The goal of racial justice is for all of us, but if we have different experiences in injustice, then we need different tools to work for that same shared goal.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Jennifer Harvey, who is a professor at Drake University and the author of a new book called Raising White Kids, Bringing Up Children in a Racially Unjust America. I wonder if you would share with our listeners a very intriguing personal story from very early in your childhood, in fact, all the way back to first grade. It's a remarkable way for you to begin this book. I wonder if you would share that story and then share why you wanted this story to be right at the top of this book.
Oh, yes. So when I, as I said at the beginning of our conversation, I was, you know, a white kid in Denver Public Schools in a classroom then in first grade, Stedman Elementary, that I had been bused to, and demographically was a minority, a racial minority in that classroom, because lots of white families, when busing began, pulled their kids from public schools in Denver. I didn't think anything was unusual about that. I was just in school, but one day outside the bathroom in the hallway, one of my friends, who also was white, said to me, "Hey, Jenny, we need to start a white girls club." And I remember this moment so vividly, because I literally kind of was confused and then kind of glanced down at myself and thought, oh my goodness, she's right. I am a white girl. Of course, the back of my mind now I know developmentally had known this already in some ways, but it's the first moment I remember consciously thinking, oh, yes, I'm a white girl. And she said, you know, we need to start a white girls club because there's only 6 white girls in this class. And our teacher, who was also white, overheard this conversation. And before I could really answer, our teacher stepped in and she said, girls, I don't ever want to hear you talking like that again. And she really cut us off. She was quite angry. For reasons I now appreciate, but I also, as a first grader, was really embarrassed. I felt ashamed. I didn't know what we had done that was wrong. And the reason I wanted to start with that story is because I wanted to say to adults who are reading my book, look, our kids are taking in, are navigating really complex racial dynamics in this society of necessity. They are doing that. And we adults, that was a great example of this adult who was afraid because of what we were saying. Instead of helping, sort of getting beside us and journeying with us through why that was such a complicated, problematic way to be talking about race, but also recognizing we were developmentally, this was a very innocent kind of conversation, she shut down the conversation and thus, for me, made it much more likely that for years I was not going anywhere near a conversation about race again because I knew something was wrong and bad about it, but I didn't know what. And so I just wanted to think, what could that teacher have done differently that would have been good for all the kids in the class, not just me and my white friend, but also black kids in the class and Latino kids in the class who really need white children to better navigate race if they're going to, you know, develop and maintain deep friendships, if white kids are going to be good allies to their friends. And so I just, that story just, I think that's part of where this book sort of long ago began for me.
Hmm. What's intriguing to me is 2 pages later, you talk about the violence that erupted in Ferguson, Missouri, the suburb of St. Louis. And I think many of our listeners will vividly remember the chaos of that rioting in the summer of 2014. Explain the connection between those 2 very, very different stories.
So for me, the connection is in part that devastating moment when, Michael Brown is killed, his body is left to lay on the street for hours in the hot sun, youth in Ferguson rise up, overwhelmingly nonviolent protest, militarized police step in, and so many of us who are white watching that unfold thought, oh my gosh, these images could have been images from Selma in the 1950s and 60s. These images are so eerily familiar, it's like we've progressed not at all. And so in part, I think Ferguson made lots of white liberals, and I would sort of put myself in that category in a sort of gentle way, you know, think, wow, like what are we not getting? What are we not doing that we're sort of stuck in this same moment? And in part, I also in that moment realized that was when for me as a parent, who was engaged in anti-racist activism, and I have been for a very long time, but I thought, wow, what's my conversation with my young kids about this? Do I talk about this with my children? How do I talk about it with my children? What are the consequences if I don't start talking about this with my children? And so it was those, and I realized I didn't have good answers to those questions, and that lots of other white parents who also are committed to racial justice, who are also engaged in anti-racism in many ways, I found myself in conversations with other white parents who also didn't have good answers to those questions. And so I thought, we want a different future. This means we've got to radically do different things at every level, including how we raise the next generation. And so that's what really sort of connected for me around, okay, my 3- and 4- and 5-year-old needs to have a different understanding than I had at age 3, 4, and 5, or else we're not going to move the needle.
Right. You write in this portion of the introduction, being committed to equity and justice while living in a society that is not only racially unjust and deeply segregated, but which privileges your racial group at the same time, creates unique conundrums for white people. These conundrums begin early in life and impact the racial development of white children in very powerful ways. A little later in the introduction, you point out that there are plenty of conversations that have already gone on in households across the country. It really isn't that we never talk about any of this. I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of households where this basically never gets talked about, or it gets talked about in very sort of negative and counterproductive ways, where probably racism and prejudice is actually fostered. But I would hope that in most households, the opposite is more the truth. But even in those households where conversations do occur, that is, where parents haltingly broach the topic, you fear that it is often done in ways that are ultimately not helpful and perhaps in some ways counterproductive.
Yeah.
Explain to our listeners the one dimensionality of many of these conversations that tend to take place right now.
Yeah, so probably the most prominent teaching that white parents, again, the ones, like you say, who are not trying to teach racism, probably the number one thing we tell our kids is you need to value everyone the same. You need to love everyone no matter what their skin color is. It's a kind of a version of quote-unquote color blindness. And the thing about that teaching is this. It comes from a well-intentioned place, but it doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is because we know that when we teach kids, what we're teaching kids is the value is that everyone should experience equality. But when what we tell kids is everyone is the same underneath their skin tone, they either hear that racism's not a problem, right, because everyone's just the same. That's what their 3 and 4 and 8 and 10-year-old brains hear. Or they actually hear skin color doesn't matter, and so don't hold it against your friend that they're black or that they're Latino. And so we actually, without meaning to, give them a negative notion of race, because we're not usually talking about whiteness when we say, you know, don't, everybody's the same, his skin color doesn't matter. We're not usually talking about a white person. We're talking about a child of color. And so what our kid hears is, oh, we're going to overlook this part of them. It doesn't really matter, which means that we're going to like them anyway, right? So you see how this gives them actually an internalized negative perception of difference.
Right. You know, as you're describing that, it reminds me, it seems like a little bit like if you are walking around with your child and someone is coming towards you and they are missing a limb. They
yes.
are on crutches and missing a leg, and your mother
yes.
might lean down and say, "Don't stare at them." Or if you there's a new kid who moved in on the block and they stutter, and so your mom might tell you now, you know, don't make fun of Johnny just because he stutters.
That's right.
And pretend that you should just pretend that that's not there, and what and in a, you know, probably something like that needs to be said, but maybe not exactly that, or we need to understand that when we say that, and if we say it that way, we're saying something else as well that we might not realize we are saying or conveying that's just beneath the surface.
That's right. And we're also saying, yes, we're implying there's something wrong with being black or brown or having dark skin without meaning to. And we are also, this is really important as well, people of color have said to white people over and over by now, look, my difference is beautiful and wonderful, and I want it to be seen. So we are also not listening to what communities of color have told us they that matters to them about how they are seen. And so what I need to be saying to my child is, yes, that person has, you know, beautiful brown skin. And you know what? We don't point at people, right? You know, so let's, you know, talk about the beauty of African-American communities and differences in the African-American community. And over time, talking with our, having the conversation about race and difference sort of flow off the tongue so that it's something our children learn is normal and good to talk about. and that by doing that over time, we can develop more and more complex conversations with them about difference and race, because it is difficult, and we don't want to put people in boxes and say, oh, that person has dark skin, therefore we know X, Y, and Z about him. Well, no, we don't want to make assumptions about people because of their race or what we perceive to be their racial identity. And so we do have to, over time, develop more and more complex conversations with our kids. And that's another good reason that talking about using colorblindness or not talking about difference doesn't work. Because if we aren't talking about difference, we can't develop more complex conversations with our children as they grow.
Why is it, do you think, that parents tend to gravitate towards this model, that is this model of colorblindness? What is it about that that, in a sense, is so appealing? Is it partly because it's simpler than the alternative that you kind of lay out in your book? Are we drawn to the simplicity of it, or are there other things too, you think, that make this an attractive option?
You know, I think in part it's about how lots of white adults were raised post-civil rights movement. In some ways, colorblindness is a very ill-applied way of thinking we're implementing King's call to judge people not by the color of their skin but by the content of their character. He was not talking about colorblindness when he said that, but lots of white adults today, people in my generation who came up in a post-civil rights society, were taught that, don't look at color, right? So this sort of one-dimensional misrepresentation of civil rights sort of lessons. So that's a piece of it. Lots of us were raised with that teaching who are now parenting or grandparenting. And I do think another reason is that there is a value that we're trying to instill in our children, the value of equality, the value of honoring people, whoever they are in the world. And so, again, I think that value is a good one, and it just sort of gets misrepresented when we translate that into colorblindness. But I do think there is something about either the simplicity of it or really our fear. White Americans are very afraid to talk about race. And, again, for these reasons we've discussed, that's in part because we haven't done it, we haven't practiced it, there's lots we haven't learned and haven't chosen to learn, and so a lot of white parents literally just don't know what to say to their kids other than treat everyone with dignity and treat everyone with kindness. And so if we don't know what to say and we're afraid to make mistakes, that becomes the easiest default. Well, we just value everybody the same. And so, so I have empathy for that because I recognize that that's, white parents in some ways are trying to, do no harm. Unfortunately, it does a lot of harm, and that's what we need to get more clear about and develop some skills around.
One of the things you just said reminds me of another intriguing contrast that you draw that I'd never stopped to think about before, and that is the contrast between two terms that at a glance almost seem like synonyms and yet in fact are not. And those two terms are non-racism and anti-racism.
Yes.
So explain what you see as the significant difference between the two and why that difference matters in the conversation that we're having and in the topic that your book is addressing.
Yeah, so I think non-racism is this idea that we don't want, non-racism is we don't want our children or we don't want to have ourselves negative views of people or make assumptions about people based on their race. And so in theory then, non-racism is this idea that it's just neutral. It's just a difference people happen to have and it doesn't lead us to draw any conclusions or hold any biases against somebody or falsely overvalue somebody because of their race. So that would be non-racism. Anti-racism is a posture that says racism exists. It's everywhere. And so actually what we need to be doing is raising children, whether they're white children, black children, Latino children, whatever their identity, who are anti-racist, who are equipped and committed to challenging racism when they see it, whether that's an exchange on the playground where a white child makes fun of another child because of their skin color, says something racist about that child, or whether it's at an institution, like I teach at a college, and anti-racism here means I am constantly trying to intervene in and help transform the structures that prevent racial equity from being who we are as an institution. And so the difference is significant. And I think parents, for me, the best metaphor that's helpful for understanding the difference comes from Beverly Daniel Tatum, who says that racism is smog in the air. We are all breathing it in all the time, whether we want to be or not. And so if racism is smog, if we aim for non-racism, that basically means I'm not giving my 8-year-old a breathing mask. I'm just going to say, well, don't hold negative views of people just because of their race. Anti-racism is a choice to put a breathing mask on your kid and to say, we're going to do everything we can to filter out these toxins and equip your body, your mind, your heart, your brain to ward off those toxins every time you encounter them. And that metaphor helps me really distinguish the difference. It's racism's in the air we breathe. And so we've got to equip our kids with anti-racism if we don't want them to just breathe it in and then end up breathing it right back out.
The picture you just painted, I think, prompts a question I hadn't thought I would ask you, but I think I'm going to ask this because I think there's the possibility that somebody listening to our conversation might be having this thought. In describing that racism is like smog that we are all breathing in, which is a really intriguing picture, are you in effect saying that all of us are racists, or that all of us are prone to racism or vulnerable to racist attitudes? I'm just curious if that, if we think of it in the way that you just described, if that is in a sense kind of the logical conclusion that one must draw.
Yes, I would say yes. We are all impacted by racism every single day. We're all prone to it. And not because we are, any of us, whether we're white or black or Latino, not because we are individually in our internal selves, wrong or bad people, but because all of us, regardless of our own racial identity, we are in an environment where the structures we live in are full of racism. The air we breathe is full of racist images, stereotypes. You hear, I'm thinking of the scholar Ibram Kendi, who talks about anti-racism as something that we all need to learn, because we know that, African-Americans talk a lot about internalized racism, internalized anti-blackness. Black people are vulnerable and prone to internalizing racism because of the air that they also breathe. And white people are, too. And for those of us who are white, being exposed and prone to racism, again, not because we show up on this earth as evil humans, but because we are saturated by racism in the society that we live in and the histories we've inherited, when we just breathe it in, it ends up being far more catastrophic because we also, the racist structures that we live in tend to put us in positions of power as well. And so we're in positions where we're at risk then of imposing our, whether it's explicit racism or even racist perceptions and biases we aren't aware that we have, we are at risk of imposing that on other communities. And so I think it is a logical conclusion, and it's helpful because when we mostly focus on racism as being about individuals with ill will, and certainly that's out there and that's a problem, but it's much more truthful and thus more effective to recognize that we are all taking in racism all the time. And so, yes, we are all prone to it because it's in the air that we breathe.
Hmm. We're speaking with Jennifer Harvey, who is a professor at Drake University and the author of a new book called Raising White Kids, Bringing Up Children in a Racially Unjust America. We have touched briefly on the reality that you yourself are a partner. That you are a parent. You and your partner are raising two children.
Yes.
And so this is a deeply personal issue for you, and
yeah,
something with which you are wrestling, not only in the sort of realm of the theoretical, as a scholar, but also as a parent, parenting two children and trying to do this right.
Yes.
I wonder if you could just for a moment explain that interesting balancing act in the way that you wrote this book and the way that you've approached this topic, and kind of balancing the professional perspective of a scholar with the really personal perspective of a parent living this.
Yeah, you know, and this is a really different book than anything I've written before, and because of that very thing, and I really found myself experiencing a lot of vulnerability as I wrote this book, in part because I'm, you know, publicly talking about my own parenting, and I don't. My kids are still young. They're only 8 and 10 right now, and there's lots of this that is still a journey I'm figuring out. I'm making lots of mistakes, and so that felt vulnerable, but it also feels vulnerable to write about one's children, and I wrestled with that as an author. But I really, I found myself finding this book to be kind of a labor of love on behalf of myself, my own children, and other parents. And so in that ways, it's felt much more personal to me than the other books that I've written, which feel much more, yes, as you say, academic and out of my sort of professional role as a scholar. But this is really about a problem, a challenge that we are, you know, we're in the midst of together, and partly I want to invite other white parents to wrestle and connect with each other and say, hey, I'm stuck here. How do we figure this out? This is a way of thinking about raising anti-racist white kids that really has not been done in our society before. It's a generational work, and so I'm sort of in that too. And so I don't feel like an expert. I feel like a parent with some experiences and some a skill set that I've worked on in other ways that I haven't, you know, fully figured out how to apply here. And so I'm sort of like opening up my heart and saying, well, here it is. This is what I'm trying. This is what I'm doing. And this is why I'm making these choices. And it's very possible lots needs to be revised here. So let's talk about it.
Mm. So in other words, you are taking your experience and expertise and applying it to your parenthood. And at the same time, you're learning from that parenting. I mean,
exactly.
As you're experiencing the reality of trying to put into practice words that might be very tidy and clear on the page, but maybe not so tidy and clear to implement. I also want to ask you about something that you go into in this chapter called Where Do I Start, which is where you begin to lay out some practical suggestions for parents wanting to do this well. As you're talking about that, you also talk about the fact that your children are being raised by two women,
mm-hmm.
You and your partner, and that in a sense, what they have experienced in a world that still, in some respects, can sometimes be heteronormative, that nevertheless, you know, they are charting a path in which it's, you know, to put it simplistically, it's okay to have two moms.
Yeah, right.
But I wonder if you could just talk for a moment about how you see that in relationship to this other question, and if there's value in kind of looking at their experience and your experience in raising your children to be okay with this, how that relates to this other matter of raising them to be racially sensitive and empathetic.
Well, I think one way that it relates for me is I realize, you know, I hear, you know, as a lesbian identified person in the U.S., I've heard parents and I've had folks in my family for whom this sort of, there was this intense fear around sexual orientation, different sexual orientations, and this idea that, well, I want to love and include you, but I can't really tell my kid who you are until they're a little older and they can understand this, right? And so maybe when my child is 12, I'll tell them that, oh, their aunt is gay, right? So the connection for me that was a really helpful insight for when I think about my own children, and I say this in the book, they are never, you know, they've never had a moment where they didn't think it was completely right and normal that you could have multiple moms, right? So they're not going to have to be pulled aside when they're 12, and someone's not going to have to say, well, guess what? You can be gay or you can have two moms. And what that has done for them is that when they encounter heteronormativity, which they do, or when they hear kids at school say, two women can't be married, my kids think that is just strange that people think that, because they know that of course you can have two moms, and they know of course two women can be married. And so that sort of scheme in their minds has helped them be more insulated and more able just to sort of persist through living in and for the kind of world that we're seeking to create by, you know, allowing diverse families to thrive and be seen. And the relationship to race here for me is profound, because I also will hear white parents say things like, my kids don't understand what race is, and so I'm going to just wait for a little while till I talk to them about it. Or a five-year-old can't really understand what racism is. Why would I want to sort of spoil their innocence? Let me, like, you know, they'll get there eventually. And I realized early in my parenting journey that that was a great correlation, because what happens is if we actually realize, talk about race, introducing the truth about race in our society, which is both that racism is real and that people are always resisting it, that if we did that younger, just like my kids think it is normal to have multiple moms, white kids could think it's normal that you fight racism when you see it, it's normal to talk about difference, and they would much earlier just sort of develop this ability to persist through complex racial conversations. And so that connection for me was really helpful, because I thought it was sort of a parallel to how sometimes I would think, wow, you're going to just wait and tell your kid when they're 14 that gay people exist? Well, that's a problem, right? My kids knew gay people existed when they were, you know, 9 months old, and they were always good with it. And so we could do something similar with white children's, consciousness about race.
I'm reminded of an interview some years ago with a book about adoption. And this author, who was quite an expert on adoption, remembered a woman coming up to him holding her adopted infant daughter and whispering, when should we tell her she's adopted? You know, as if this infant could even, you know, understand those words. And he whispered back to her, on the way home. Because, you know, the thought is this is something absolutely true and nothing to be afraid of. And
that's right.
The sooner you talk about it in normal terms, the better. Just a couple more questions. What would be one or two of your suggestions for parents in terms of how to talk about this? I mean, specifically how to talk about some of these issues. Just one or two of your suggestions among many that are in the book.
Well, with younger kids, one or two of my suggestions include, and some parents do this already, making sure we've got diverse media in our homes, we're reading diverse books, and having diverse toys and, you know, dolls, of many different kinds of dolls, and not only doing that, but also pointing it out and talking about it. So parents are always talking with their young kids, saying, oh, look at that blue shirt, look at those pink socks, you know, and doing that with race and difference. Oh, look, that baby has white skin or light peach skin, and that baby has dark brown chocolate-looking skin, and sort of just practicing as much for ourselves, too, as our kids, that having the language of difference just roll off the tongue, because that's an important building block as our kids start to navigate race in schools and preschool, where in which they're going to realize, oh, talking about this with my parent is a normal good thing to do, and there's no taboo about it. So that's a really good example.
Sure, I like that. One decision that you made was to take your, I think, both of your young children witness one of the protests of the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. I'm guessing that as some readers read that, their eyebrows might go up just a little bit.
Yeah.
But this was a choice that was important to you. Explain what was at the heart of that choice.
So the heart of that choice to begin taking my kids to protests very young was that I wanted them, even before we had language and concepts that we could explain it exactly, I wanted our kids to be in spaces where they saw people resisting racism and resisting racial violence. And it was in some moments it's been a difficult choice, especially when they were younger, because I also, like any parent, whatever the child's race, want to make good decisions about how much they hear about violence. I don't want to invoke fear. I don't want to overexpose them before, you know, too young to the violence of, say, police brutality, for example, against black and brown people. But I decided that it was important for them. I want their sense of normal, right, their earliest sense of what you do, part of it to be this idea that when there is injustice, you fight it and you get with other people. And especially as a white person, you get with people of color and you fight it with them. And so that was really important for me, and I decided to take the risk of bringing them into spaces where they might hear more things than I wanted them to about the actual violence of police brutality, for example, in this case. But that was a better error to make, and that risk was a better risk than to over-insulate them, especially as white kids, if I want them to be prepared over time to be good allies in partnership and in solidarity with people of color.
Hmm. Your children are, I think, under 10, younger than 10?
Correct. Well, 8 and 10, yep.
It will be interesting to see, and I'm sure you think it's going to be interesting, too, also to see what it's like to help them navigate these same issues as they become older. How much do you think about that?
I think about that all the time. And one of the ways I think about it is I think about, we know, and lots of white parents I've heard talk about this, that we know that youth in the teenage years, even kids who have diverse friendship groups as young kids, those friendship groups get more and more segregated as they go through the teenage years. And I think about it all the time because I think part of that, there's probably a lot of complex reasons, but part of it is that our kids, they, you know, experience the same racial tensions that adults do. They become deeply aware of those tensions. And I think also white youth who have not been taught about the realities of racism, it becomes more difficult for them to sustain authentic friendships because teenagers of color are, of course, navigating racism every day, know that they are doing so. And so those friendships, I think, in part erode because white youth are not getting taught about the reality of the racism that their friends are experiencing. So when I think about it with my young kids, I think I'm constantly thinking, how am I making sure that when my older daughter is in eighth grade in her hopefully diverse friendship networks, how am I making sure that she can really stay in those conversations and relationships because she's believing people, they're not having to overly educate her, she assumes that she has a place right alongside her friends in standing with them and supporting them as they, you know, experience racism and challenge racism. And so I think about it all the time, and it goes back to the vulnerability. I'm sure I'm making lots of mistakes, but I think constantly about what will my 14-year-old white teenager do when racism happens at the high school that she's in. What do I need to be teaching her now to hopefully make it more likely she's going to show up in the ways I want her to show up at age 14 in a high school where I know she's going to encounter racism.
Hmm. And when she's 18, and when she's 28,
right.
And when she's 48.
That's
and so.
Right, all of it. I can barely get past 14, though.
right, exactly. The book is Raising White Kids, Bringing Up Children in a Racially Unjust America. The book is published by Abingdon Press, and the author, Jennifer Harvey. Professor Harvey, I thank you most profoundly for writing this remarkable book that gives all of us so much to think about, and I appreciate this opportunity to talk with you about it on The Morning Show. Very best
Greg,
wishes to
so
you.
Thanks so much. Thank you so much, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I will be honored to speak with Dr. John Swallow. He is the president of Carthage College, and President Swallow will be joining me to talk about some of his hopes and dreams for Carthage's future. Friday's Morning Show will include a preview of the production that opens at the Racine Theater Guild this weekend, a production of the play Wait Until Dark. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org. There you will find several years' worth of morning show interviews for you to enjoy at your pleasure. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again. And that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva,